quality of the real Quintic. Yes? I'm sorry? It's too small. I can write the little larger, yes, okay. So let me start with the definition. So let's consider W a polynomial in n variables. I will call this ring R. And I will always assume that W has an isolated critical point at the origin. Just for simplicity. And then a pair of matrices F and G in some size of matrices which satisfy F times G equals G times F equals W times the identity matrix. It's called a matrix factorization of W. Okay. So, well, what's the origin of these matrix factorizations? Actually goes back to Eisenbart. In 1980, who essentially showed that matrix factorizations describe so-called maximal Kolmogorov-Gauli modules over hypersurface singularities. So if I define M the co-kernel of F, then M has a free resolution a length one free resolution like this, and then if I multiply with W, then this will be homotopic to zero, and then over S, the hypersurface ring, M will have an infinite two-periodic resolution like this. And by the Auslander-Buxbaum-Serre formula, the depth of this module M is equal to the dimension of S. And so this is known as maximal Cohen-Mergauli module. Over the hypersurface S. And the theorem by Eisenbart tells you that all maximal Kolmogorov-Gauli modules come from such matrix factorizations. And so these matrix factorizations had lots of interesting applications in the 80s in the context of singularity theory. I'm sorry? Oh, over W, F times G is W. I'm sorry, this is S. So over more W, this is zero. Okay. So this is the origin of matrix factorizations, but then And then F again. Sorry, this is G is on the arrow. Okay. Then the story starts again with Concevich, around 2002, who proposed to use matrix factorizations to describe triangulated categories of B brains in Landau-Ginzburg models. So you start with Z2 graded three R modules. M is N0 plus M1, and I will denote the grading by sigma, the Z2 grading, and an odd endomorphism Q satisfying Q squared equal to W. And then these R modules with with morphisms, just the morphisms of three modules, they form a DG category. With the differential for phi, some morphism is defined by Q prime phi minus sigma prime phi sigma Q for phi in Hom R. And I will always, well, M and MQ always go together, I will usually denote this by Q, okay? So what this means is that, so then you have this Z2 graded DG category, and you can then you can pass to the homotype category, where you restrict the morphisms to the cohomology of, you pass to the cohomology of D, and then you get the triangulated category. Of matrix factorizations. And I will denote this by little mf of W. And so note that this category is Z2 graded as it stands, but we will improve on that shortly. Okay, now let me talk about physics. So from the physical perspective, what are matrix factorizations? Matrix factorizations are the solution of the so-called Wohner problem. Sigma is the grading, the Z2 grading, so sigma squared is equal to 1. Sigma is just the matrix 1, 0, 0, minus 1. So the rank of M0 must be equal to the rank of M1, otherwise there is no such Q. So from physics perspective, matrix factorizations are a solution of the so-called Wohner problem. So what is the Wohner problem? Well, you can use I'm sorry? I'm looking at two matrix factorizations, Q and Q prime. This is minus one to the phi. z 2 greater phi. Yeah, as I said, that I will usually confuse M and Q. But you're right. So what is, any other questions? Okay. So matrix factorization provides a solution of the Wonner problem. So to this W, one associates in N equals 2,2 supersymmetric Landau-Ginzburg model. And in particular, there is a term in this Wall Street action which contains integration over W over the Wall Street sigma. And then if you compute, so then if you allow the sigma to have a boundary, as you do if you want to describe D-brains, and then you consider the supersymmetry variation of this, then this is given by actually a boundary term. Like this. I mean, this is really, so this is really a non-conventional thing, because usually you assume that, well, if the the supersymmetry variation is such that you that it actually preserves the boundary, and usually if you have an integrate, if you have an action like this and you vary it with respect to a vector field which actually vanishes on the boundary, then there should not be any boundary term. But here it's because of the special properties of of the peculiar properties of supersymmetry, this is not true. Okay. So how do matrix factorization solve the Wonner problem? I will not explain all the details, but essentially introduces so this that this these are the solutions of the Wonner problem. This was shown by Kapustin and Lee, and also by Brunner, perhaps Lerche Scheuner. So this one introduces boundary degrees of freedom. And boundary interactions for them. And these boundary interactions are encoded in the Q. So Q is this combination of matrices in terms of the F and G there over here, this odd matrix Q. And the condition for supersymmetry is equivalent to Q squared equal to W. Okay, but then for physics, there just supersymmetry is not quite enough. There are two more conditions that I will be talking about, and one is conformal invariance, and then this will lead to an the grading, the Z grading of the this category, and then also unitarity. And this will lead to a stability condition. So this is joint work with Kentaro Hori. and some work in progress. So how do we get this grading? So we know that if we had world sheets without boundaries, then the condition for conformal invariance was that W be quasi-homogeneous. So what this means is that you have that there is some rational numbers qi such that W of e to the I lambda qi xi is equal to e to the 2i lambda w of xi. So I will normalize these degrees of the variables such that the degree of w is 2. That's convenient to do. Okay, so now if you have these boundaries, you can ask what is the analog statement there. And there you will require that Q be quasi-homogeneous. So then maybe you think this is just that the entries are quasi-homogeneous, but it's not quite that. So Q quasi-homogeneous means that there is a matrix R such that if I rescale the X's like this, and then conjugate Q with e to the I lambda R, then this gives charge 1 to Q. Okay, so in other words, I have, I'm equipping this matrix factorization with the C star action, or U1 action, and then a C star action, such that Q is equivariant. Okay. So to see a little better what this condition is, let me write this infinitesimally. So let me define E as some, the Euler vector field, qi xi d by dxi. Then the condition of quasi-homogeneity of W is EW is 2W. And the condition on the Q is that EQ plus R commutator Q is equal to Q. And this actually shows you that this is a topological condition, because if you compute EQ, if you compute the anticommutator of Q with EQ minus Q, then this is, well, it's just E on Q squared minus 2Q squared. And by this by Q squared equal W on this condition, this is 0. So EQ minus Q is actually closed. And so the existence of this matrix R is a condition that this closed form be exact. Okay, so once we have this matrix R, we can go ahead and grade our morphisms with Q. This is the supercommutator. I will assume this, yes. So I will, okay, generally I would like to assume that R be an even matrix. And then I think I can always conjugate this matrix to being, I can always diagonalize it. Maybe I want to require that R be even, be have degree 0. Okay. So now we have morphisms are Q graded, but and how are they Q graded? Well, essentially, if I have any morphism, I can act on it with the Euler vector field r prime phi minus phi r, and this will define the grade or charge of phi. So this is again for phi some morphism. If you want first some m to m prime, or a little. Okay, now to make this Q grading into a Z grading, we are going to do something that physicists call orbifolding. Which is essentially a projection onto morphisms of integral charge. So let's say H is the smallest integer such that HQI is an even integer for all I. Then the W is invariant under the ZH action, where omega I is e to the I pi QI. And okay, and then if you restrict, for example, to ZH invariant part of the Jacobi ring R mod dW, then this has even R charge. Okay. Now, if we want to extend this to the matrix factorizations, this means we're looking for ZH action on these modules also, which means that you have some gamma, which means like this, omega I xi gamma inverse is Q of xi with gamma h equal to 1. And actually, because we have already the R grading, you can always find such a matrix. So we take gamma equal to e to the I pi r sigma. You take e to the I pi r, then the Q will pick up a minus sign, and then you multiply with sigma this Q with the minus sign again. But then you satisfy this equation, but it might not yet actually be the H action. So you have to multiply with another phase, e to the I phi. So this is such that the gamma commutes with Q, and this phase is such that gamma to the H is equal to 1. And this phase, phi, is actually, so phi is then, this is just a number, and if I assume that my, matrix factorization is irreducible, then this phi will be uniquely determined by this condition. And I will lift the phi to R, and then this will give me, if you want, the slope of the matrix factorization here. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention one more thing. To make this unique, I also have to so unique is Q irreducible, and also trace R equal to 0. And then, so once I have this gamma, then I will restrict to gamma invariant morphisms. And then it's easy to see that Q phi is phi prime minus phi mod z for phi in the cohomology of Q to Q prime. Okay, and then the matrix factorizations are essentially z graded. And I will denote this category by capital MF of W. Okay. And so now we have all these ingredients. And okay, so then there should be this conjecture that that these matrix this category of matrix factorization of W is actually equivalent to the derived category of X, where X is so this matrix, these are the quasi-homogeneous gamma equivariant, sorry, ZH equivariant matrix factorizations of W. And this should be the derived category of the appropriate Calabi-Yau that's related to W via the gauge linear sigma model. I'm sorry? Via this, the gauge linear sigma model. So the simplest, in the simplest case, it's just the corresponding hypersurface W equals 0. So for example, if W is the quintic, is a quintic polynomial in five variables, and you divide just by the Z5, the diagonal Z5, then X is the hypersurface, the quintic hypersurface in P4. I don't want to, yeah, so this is the gauge linear sigma model of Witten that relates to Calabi-Yau. No, this is not mirror symmetry. This is all on the B model track. Well, this is not always the relation. Okay, now let me mention one more. Do I have time or should I? Okay, let me just mention very briefly. There is an index theorem. There's an index theorem for matrix factorization. So you can define something like a churn map, which for Q, this will just be the super trace of gamma for gamma in your orbifold group. And then there is this index theorem which says that Q to Q prime, this is equal to some appropriate pairing between the two churn characters. Okay. Where, for example, in the for the quintic, this is this pairing n from 1 to 4. 1 over 1 minus omega inverse to the 5 super trace gamma to the minus n, where omega is e to the 2 pi I. Okay, so let me now well, it gives you a number for every element of the orbifold group. Over the M. So this is trace of sigma gamma over the C2-graded module. Over the Z2-graded module. Just a trace of the matrix. Well, one is zero. Okay, yes. Four complex numbers. In general, they're complex numbers. And then there is a change of basis which maps these two turn characters of. You're right. It's more complicated in the general case. And this is why I don't. The churn character will be more complicated. There will be some I'm not exactly sure, but okay, so now I want to talk about stability condition. And essentially, this comes from the unitarity constraint. So unitary CFTs, so in the conformal field theory is this Q-grade, or it says this is called the R-charge. And in unitary CFTs, there is a constraint that Q lie between 0 and C hat, where C hat is the central charge of the CFT. And for example, for these Landau-Ginzburg models, you can compute it as like so. In singularity theory, this is known as the singular index of your singularity. So the stability that I have in mind is essentially a version of what's known as pi stability evaluated at the Landau-Ginzburg point. So pi stability in the sense of Douglas Douglas Aspinwall, and then formalized by Bridgeland, is essentially the interpretation of this unitarity constraint, so of 0 less than Q less than C hat, as a stability condition. On triangulated categories of topological topological grains. And so let me then try to give a definition of what this will read here. So a matrix factorization Q is R stable if in all triangles Q, Q1, Q2, so if in all triangles where this here is this the degree one morphism, this is the odd, so the Q is opposite to the side where it's zero, opposite to the and if I call this map T here, then I require that QT less than one. Okay, and if I put an equal here, then this will be semi-stable. Okay. So now, so this should be, this is really the just the formulation of this idea of Douglas et al. For this case of the matrix factorizations. But so this should be, well, the idea is that this should then be a stability condition in the sense of Bridgeland. And if you look at the definitions of Bridgeland, there are two things that one has to check. One is this, that if phi, phi is greater than phi prime, then hom of Q, Q prime vanishes. But and if you look through the definitions, then what this is essentially Q of phi, phi prime minus phi, where this this up here, this is the Q grade that we had. And then you go through this definition, and you see that this this is sort of trivially satisfying. Phi was the slope of the matrix factorization in R. So gamma was e to the I pi R sigma e to the I phi. So phi was chosen such that such that gamma was in the h power of gamma was equal to 1. Sorry, it's real or rational? Well, it's rational, but it's also real. Sorry, it's not complex. I wouldn't. Okay. Sorry? Sorry? No, this this stability condition, this is for the unordered folding. But this over here, this is probably only true for the orbifolded folding one. Okay, so then the second condition, which I'm not sure I can check, but is that the existence of these generalized are the Narasimhan filtrations. Which for me is just that any object, whether it's stable, well, if it's stable, then it's stable, but if it's unstable, then it will have some decay chain. Then it will decay into stable pieces by some sequence of triangles like this. Up to Qn. But this is zero, and phi n is greater than phi n minus one, so it's greater than phi one. The p's are stable, yes, so the condition in pi. Or semi-stable. Sorry? This? I think it should hold also in the unorbifolded case. Yeah. I think it should hold also in the unorbifolded case. Okay, but does it bother you if it's only for the orbifolded? Well, I think it should. Why should it not work also for the? I mean, you have also the conformal field theory, so why should that not be? Why should that not work for the unorbifolded case? Okay, that might, yeah, Bridgeland might not work in that case, but. The orbifolding actually does something very minor because it only splits each object into H objects, keeping only the morphism to a certain degree. Okay, so maybe we can discuss this later. But, well, this is the constraint on the R charges that they be between 0 and CF. I can talk about this even if I haven't orbifolded. That's right. Well, okay, maybe we can discuss this later. Okay, so yeah, really, one motivation for one consequence of calling this a stability condition should be that there should be some construction of moduli spaces for these matrix factorizations. So if I have some Q, 2n by 2n matrix with polynomial entries, with Q squared equal to W, then I can consider similarity transformation. Q goes to Q U inverse, where U so U will be in GL and R. I will restrict only to so in what I'm going to say now, there is more, probably more questions that I don't know the answer to. So I think one should look at only the even similarity transformation. And so then one will look at matrices in GL and R, times GL and R. And then one would like to understand what is the quotient of the space of matrix factorizations by this gauge proof here. Or maybe for me, what I would like to understand is how to split the object into the stable pieces. Okay, so maybe the most general gauge group that one can consider. But if one is in the graded case, then maybe one wants to restrict actually to degree zero transformations. So let me actually write these here infinitesimally. So let me write this as delta Q is V commutator with Q. And then degree zero gauge transformations G, that would be all the V's which have EV plus RV equal to zero, where E is again the Euler vector field and R is this R matrix that I was having. So then for these ones, then the R is actually invariant under the gauge transformations, because in general the R, one can check, R transforms as delta R is minus EV plus R commutator V. So this is actually set to zero for the degree zero morphisms. So I think one should restrict to those. Although it's probably an interesting question, what is the meaning of the other gauge transformations which are not of degree zero? But even leaving this question aside, my biggest problem that I have if I want to quotient by this group is that this group is actually not reductive. So G is not reductive, because essentially there is some nilpotent ideal, which is essentially the ones that contain non-trivial polynomials. This is just EG, because polynomial degree is also conserved under, if you take commutators, so it adds up, and then this will be nilpotent. But so of the two things that I know about, geometric invariant theory apparently is not completely unheard of for non-reductive groups, although I don't know if it's very standard. And the other technique, symplectic quotient construction, using moment maps and so on, that seems even less clear how to do this. if there were, so if this gauge group were actually reductive, then one could consider a moment map like this, minus trace RV. So this would be the moment map mu q for the element of the Lie algebra V, where this here is just any inner product that you choose. So, for example, one can choose this sum of all monomials trace Q alpha dagger Q alpha, where Q is decomposed into sum of monomials like this. And so, in essentially, this moment map, well, it gives you the correct answer if this sketch group were reductive, and also for the reductive part of this sketch group. But I'm not sure what is the appropriate generalizations for non-reductive groups. Okay. Any questions? This is Dagger. Question? Yeah? Right. No, this is stability condition just at one point in the moduli space. This is just one stability condition. I don't think. Should they always be in a abelian category? I don't know. Yeah, Anton? Yes, Anton. It's possible. I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure, but I mean, the way I got that this stability condition is just following the idea of Douglas that this stability should be essentially related to the unitarity constraint on the R-tri. No, well, I have a Q grading. The only thing you don't have if you don't orbifold is you don't have a Z. You don't have projected the Q grading to a Z grading. That's all you. But that's, I think that's different from Fano, because in Fano you have some Z mod H grading, where H is some. So this is. Do you mean they have the Maslow class, which is not there? Yeah, this is essentially the Maslow. So the analog of the Maslow class is essentially this EQ minus Q. That this is EQ minus Q that this is 0 in H1 of Q. Okay, so it looks like I will not get at all to part 2 of the talk. Okay, thank you very much. Sorry? Yes. Yes, sure. So essentially, it concerns, well, part two was supposed to be shorter than part one, but not that much shorter. So consider the quintic sum vi to the 5 equals 0 in P4, and then consider the real locus of that, which is a special Lagrangian. And then consider the Fleur cohomology of this Lagrangian. And so to make it very short, there is the Fleur complex, which is some sort of deformation of the Morse complex. So the Morse complex delta would be 2. I'm sorry, I should say one more thing. So L is topologically in RP3, as many of you probably know. Okay, so this would be the Morse complex for RP3. And then the Fleur complex is some sort of deformation of this where you add holomorphic disks. Okay, that's like, well, in the ball case, you start out with 5, and then you add the holomorphic spheres. And so then the statement that I wanted to make is that, well, we know what is the mirror matrix factorization of this Lagrangian here. Let me remind you that the scalar moduli space of the quintic has these three singular points, large volume, conifold, and the Lambert-Ginzburg or Gapner point. And so we can study the mirror matrix factorization on this whole moduli space. And essentially we find that at this point there is so if you take the cohomology of this complex, then you find with complex coefficients, you find nothing in degree 1 and degree 2. But if you look at the mirror matrix factorization, you find that there is something at degree 1 at the Lambert-Ginzburg point. So this would be at the Lambert-Ginzburg point. So the prediction is that if you compute this Fleur co-boundary operator, sum of all homomorphic disks, and then you analytically continue this to this point, you will find that it vanishes. So the prediction. Right, and you can maybe make a stronger prediction, which essentially identifies this delta with some function that you compute in the matrix factorization, and you could use that to compute the holomorphic disk on this side. Okay, this is. Otherwise, I would have given only part 2 of the talk.